everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. So I've been on Zoom since 5 a.m. today. I started out with a call with Ukraine Solidarity people, mostly Europe, but some in Brazil and the U.S. and Canada, and then a state committee meeting for the Green Party in New York. So I haven't looked at my email yet, but let me give you a little report on, what the people in Europe were saying. Last weekend was the anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and there were solidarity demonstrations with Ukraine all over Europe, as well as some demonstrations opposing Western European countries providing arms for Ukraine's self-defense. But they were far outnumbered in the terms of number of demonstrations and in the size of demonstrations by those demonstrations that were in solidarity with Ukraine. And we heard reports from people in England, Scotland, Ireland, France, Spain, Germany, Sweden, Poland, Hungary, and Brazil, and the U.S. And basically, the picture is the Ukrainian diaspora took the lead on the solidarity demonstrations, but they welcome people. These are mostly people on the far socialist left in Europe and Brazil and the U.S., but let them and welcome their giving, talks, speeches from the platform. You may have heard of a demonstration. A lot of the campus have been pushing it as a big demonstration in Germany that was led by Sarah Wagenknecht, who's from Die Linke, the left party, and Alice Schwarzer, a longtime kind of liberal feminist, but is now an anti-trans feminist. And what marred that demonstration, besides the fact that they were calling for an end to arms to Ukraine, was that there are a lot of right-wingers there, including from the Alternative for Germany, which is the far-right party in Germany. And there were tablers, people who wanted to distribute their literature who were from Russian ethnic minorities from Asia. And they were threatened with violence by these right-wingers at that demonstration. That demonstration, the official count from the police is 13,000, maybe it got up to 15,000, but the solidarity demonstration in Berlin had over 100,000. And that was kind of the picture around Germany, 2-to-1 ratio at least. What that I think should tell us is that this German demonstration, the right wing is coming out for these demonstrations against arms to Ukraine, but that red-brown alliance is weaker than the solidarity demonstration, but it's still dangerous because the far right has no problem with taking violence against racial minorities and the left. And it's weak in this country. That Rage Against the War Machine demo was, pretty pathetic in terms of numbers. But there were far-right people there present, and you had a lot of Russian imperial flags and posters from the LaRouche movement all over the place. And then some far-right people from, these white supremacist groups showed up to the table. So I'd say it's weak, but it's a concern. And I would also note, and this was reported, that even those demonstrations that were, the slogan was no to NATO, but they were calling for an end to arms to Ukraine. They still were calling for Russian troops out of Ukraine. Like the biggest one was the Stop the War demonstration in Trafalgar Square in London. And that's in contrast to the so-called anti-war demonstrations that have been organized by the Answer Coalition and Code Pink and the United Anti-War Coalition. They won't say, they don't demand Russian troops out. They don't defend Ukraine's right to self-determination. So they are further into the, apology for Russian imperialism than even those demonstrations in Europe that were calling for an end to arms to Ukraine. And as Yulia Yurchenko, who we had on this podcast last September, pointed out in the Ukraine Solidarity Network event online that we held last Saturday. She was speaking from Trafalgar Square outside that Stop the War coalition. There were more counter demonstrators there. And one of the things she noted that is that there were no Ukrainians speaking from the platform of Stop the War. They were all out opposing their position of cutting off arms to Ukraine, which of course they would say, and I agree with them, that if Ukraine doesn't have the arms to defend itself, Russia's gonna recolonize the whole country. So that's a report on what happened last weekend from Europe. And I mentioned Brazil. I couldn't, even though they had a translator, I couldn't quite get the picture there, although it sounded like it was somewhat more difficult for the internationalists in Brazil. So that's that report. So meanwhile, you know, everybody was focused on this trial of this guy in South Carolina. It seemed to dominate the news, but a lot of other things happened. And, you know, the Biden administration is, you know, even though I think they're pretty much right on Ukraine, they're wrong on everything else. Jesus. I'm not religious, but it comes out. I'll give you four examples. There's this nuclear power plant in Diablo Canyon in California that sits on earthquake faults. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, which I like to say stands for Nobody Really Cares, just approved the continued operation of Diablo Canyon at the request of PG&E, the big private utility out there. And that's unprecedented for the NRC. They usually require a safety review before they extend the operating permit, which is expired after 40 years and its planned lifetime. Instead, it's been extended without a review. And PG&E has already got Governor Newsom out there, a Democrat, to renege on a shutdown plan they'd agreed to for Diablo Canyon that was agreed to by PG&E, the unions that work in that industry, and state government. And then they reversed their decision. They say because they need it for carbon-free energy, but the costs of solar and wind have gone down so fast. And the other thing Newsom did was he approved a policy that cut the payments of net metering for people that put solar installations on their homes. So are they really serious about going no carbon? That has really crippled the home solar industry in California. So that's Biden and your Democrats for you. And then we have this week Biden saying that he will not veto a Republican bill that got about 40 Democrats in the House to vote for that overrules a decision by the District of Columbia, DC City Council on criminal justice reforms, like reducing some of the exorbitant sentences. So for example, they reduced the maximum sentence for carjacking from 40 years to 24 years, which is still a substantial penalty. And the more important point is they are, you know, denying DC its right to self-government, as well as the right to make criminal justice reforms that can improve, deal with this mass incarceration problem we got. So what that says is we need DC statehood, which the Democrats on paper are for, but they never move in the House. When they had a majority in the House and the Senate, it didn't move. So that's the second beef. A third one is immigration policies. I mean, Biden has expelled 2.4 million asylum seekers, mostly using Title 42, a law or regulation that the Trump administration got passed, using the COVID emergency as an excuse to expel people, deport them without any due process on their asylum claims. And now that is in jeopardy in the courts, a federal court invalidated it, but the damn Supreme Court held that ruling and sent it to the appeals court to be re-argued. In the meantime, the Biden administration is putting in place rules that will have the same effect and allow them to deport these people without due process. So our inhumane immigration policy that Biden said he would reverse is not being reversed. And then finally, we've seen these deadly Israeli raids and disposition of Palestinians' homes and land on the West Bank under this extreme right-wing government that's come to power in Israel. And there's silence from the Biden administration on that, which is why I think we need to start pushing for BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel until it recognizes the human and political rights of Palestinians and starts negotiating with them seriously about a long-term solution. Instead, we have a government in Israel that's just about expelling the Palestinians from their land and denying them their right to participate. That's really what the right wing of that coalition wants. And the administration is silent. It's, you know, whatever Israel wants to do, we'll let them do it. You know, previously they affirmed the Trump administration decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, which was, you know, should be a city where, you know, both Palestinians and Israelis are live and are welcome, but moving the embassy there just reinforces the moves by the Israeli administration to take over East Jerusalem from the Palestinians. So, you know, I could go on the terrible policies we're getting from the Biden administration, but I think, you know, the conclusion to draw is we need the Green Party. We really need to be running candidates that challenge these policies, put forward our positive program, and start selecting people. It's got to start from the local level and the state level and get to the House, but I hope we can move that way fast, because right now, between the climate crisis, the new nuclear arms race, the crisis of inequality, which is killing people because people are having to choose between, you know, buying medicine that they need or paying the rent or the utility bill, and getting sick and dying in some cases. The man that lived below me in this duplex I live in decided 2 years ago now that he would forego his kidney medicine for a month so he could catch up on his winter utility bills that he got behind on. And by the end of that month, he was dead. That's the kind of thing that our damn system is forcing people into. And the Democrats, you know, single-payer healthcare is off their agenda. Yeah, there's some progressives that are for it, but you know, the mainstream, the leadership, the people in control of the Democratic Party are not for that. In fact, the Biden administration has a policy now under the direction of Elizabeth Fowler, who wrote the Obamacare's public subsidies for private insurance, is now head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And her goal is to privatize all Medicare and Medicaid accounts with things like Medicare Advantage and you know, HMO management of Medicare accounts. So they're privatizing the system when it's the opposite of what we should be going. So we need the Green Party more than ever. And so let's go to questions and comments. Frankie Lee, the big rally on March 18th won't have any fascist LaRouche bunch though. And no Nick Brana, who just wants people's money. Yeah, you're right about the difference between, what was it? Forget the date, but the Rage Against the War Machine rally and the one on March 18th. You know, my problem with the one on March 18th, it bills itself as peace in Ukraine, an anti-war rally, but it won't condemn the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It won't call for the Russian troops out. It doesn't support the right of Ukraine to self-determination, in calling for cutting off the arms to Ukraine. If that were to happen, Ukraine would not be able to defend itself and Russia would recolonize all of Ukraine. And as an internationalist, a socialist, a green, I believe we should support the right of people to self-determination and support their national liberation struggles. And this doesn't. So while the right wingers are not invited to the March 18th demo, that demo I don't consider anti anti-war or anti-imperialist. We got to be against all imperialisms, Russian as well as U.S. Via email, response to expanded SNAP benefits ending. Yeah, that's part of ending the COVID emergency package. And, you know, that plus the another thing that's already been ended, the child credit, you know, that's pushing more people into poverty and more extreme poverty. And again, that shows where the priorities of this government are. It's answering to the funders of campaigns who are rich folks, not to the people, in this case, the Democratic Party. You know, working people tend to vote more for the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party is not listening to them. It's listening to its donors. So, yeah, the SNAP benefits for people that got them under the COVID emergency, you know, they should be able to get them. Anybody that might be hungry because they can't get SNAP benefits should get them. We shouldn't be stingy about feeding people. That's why we need the Green Party. Frankie Lee, have you heard anything about canceling Social Security survivors benefits? I have not. I was actually a beneficiary of that because my mother died when I was very young and I got payments until I turned 18, which I used basically to pay for my first two quarters of college, which back then was much more affordable. So I had not heard about that, but that's what the Social Security system was set up to do, is to help people who, if you know, they lose a parent and therefore likely lose income for their families, that the children would be taken care of. So I had not heard about that, but I will look into that. That's a terrible idea. Lomboy Wilson, I would like the Green Party to support a $100 million lifetime income cap where all income streams and fortunes in excess of $100 million are seized. Yeah, there's been an idea that actually Roosevelt raised, I don't know how seriously, of having a maximum annual income with 100% tax on that income above that cap. And I don't know if $100 million, I mean, the problem with that is the value of the dollar changes. So I think you don't want to put a concrete number on it. But the principle I agree with, and we really need a much more progressive tax system that not only deals with income, if you really want to challenge economic inequality, you got to go after wealth. So we need a wealth tax that's progressive. And the states, an estate tax that is more progressive than what we got now, if we still have one. I'm forgetting the details, but you know, one of those Republican bills made it expire. And then financial transactions, you know, the people with all this money are playing the stock market and the bond market, and those are sales. And we're all paying sales taxes on most of the stuff we buy, but they don't pay a sales tax when they buy stocks or you know, when they sell and buy. So a financial transaction tax is another tax that would be progressive. We should have land value taxation so that speculators can't just buy properties and sit on them hoping the value will go up without doing anything with them. A land value tax would tax the value of the land, not the improvements, which would create incentive for people who own that land to improve them or at least use them so they can pay the property tax or the land value tax. But if people want to improve their properties, their taxes don't go up, which would do a lot to improve the quality of buildings in businesses in that are already there in cities. So I'm trying to remember all the different forms of progressive taxation we need. The corporate tax needs to be increased and more progressive. The first thing they could do is get rid of those damn Trump tax cuts, which the Democrats promised, and when they had the majority in both houses, didn't do. So, yeah, we need more progressive taxation. That's how we're going to fund, in large part, the eco-socialist Green New Deal, an economic bill of rights that provides a real baseline of living standards from, you know, the right to employment and an income above poverty to housing, healthcare, education, and a secure retirement. Violet at Content Boutique. No more foreign buyers of our American property. I wouldn't go that far. I think that's kind of being nationalistic. And, you know, what we want is an international economic system that is equitable with fair trade, and not be paranoid when foreigners invest in our, you know, society. I mean, when they buy U.S. Treasury bonds, that helps finance government spending. And a lot of people overseas put their money there because it's seen as the safest investment. So I wouldn't be so blanket. I would say we should have incentives to diversify our own economy, particularly in manufacturing, so that we have our own supply chains and they're not subject to political decisions by other powers. We had a problem with getting medicines in the COVID emergency because a lot of them are produced in China. The chip industry, China, and particularly Taiwan, have a disproportionate share of that market. Biden has made some moves to do that. So I think it's more simple than just saying no foreigners can own any property here. But I do think we should have incentives to rebuild our manufacturing sector in particular. So we're not dependent. That could get us in problems of both, you know, national security or just economic prosperity. And also because it's environmentally more sensible. It's better to produce stuff closer to where they're used than to have, you know, most of our stuff, or a lot of our stuff's being imported from China, which is a big carbon emission to ship that across the ocean when it could be produced here. And by the same token, our foreign policy should be encouraging and helping with grants more than loans, other countries to do the same thing, or other continents to do the same thing, Africa, Latin America, South Asia, so that particularly when it comes to manufacturing, everybody can produce what they need within their own region. And then there's certain things like minerals or, say, agricultural products that can only be produced in certain climates, say bananas. You can't grow bananas in North Dakota, so those have to be imported. But we could have a lot more diversified local production for local use, and then have fair trade for those things that naturally need to be traded. Blind Boy Wilson, not-for-profits, churches, hospitals, universities end up devouring real estate of the communities they claim to serve, taking them off the tax rolls and raising our taxes. Yes, that's true, and they should be paying property taxes at least in the communities they are in, because they use those community services, snow plowing, sewage, water, policing, and they're getting a free ride. And then, you know, there's also the question of whether they shouldn't also be contributing to state and federal taxes with some kind of income tax or corporate tax, like the for-profit corporate taxes pay. You know, maybe it should be a lower rate because we do want to encourage those things, but the free ride thing, they become for-profit nonprofits. Real estate development's very profitable, and these nonprofits engage in it for the same profit-making reasons, to raise money, to have profits like private developers do. And so, you know, this has got out of hand. So it needs to be brought back into a more reasonable relationship to the communities. Terry Fantastic. We need global solidarity to address the devastation to the working class and the environment caused by corporate consumerist capitalist greed. From Terry in the UK Workers' Party Britain member. Yes, we do. And I think that's something that we sometimes lose when we talk about, you know, the Ukraine war, for example, is our solidarity with the masses of people in Ukraine that are, you know, fighting for their survival? Or do we ally with one of the imperialist camps, you know, the Western imperialists or the Russian imperialists? And I think too many on the left are taking a campist position instead of an international socialist position of solidarity with the oppressed. But it needs to be global. And, you know, I have a concern within the Green Party. It pulled out of the Federation of the Green Parties of the Americas, which de facto withdrew them from the Global Greens, which are coordinating networks. And they're legitimate political concerns we have with some of the parties in Latin America, which are homophobic and even anti-abortion. But I think we should have stayed inside and fought for our position. And there was actually some manipulation that wasn't democratic against us, but I think we should have stayed and fight instead of just withdrawn. And our voice is lost there where it should be. Sandman95, I'm leaving my question now since I must leave. Are you considering a 2024 run, and would you choose Angela again for VP? If I ran, I would love Angela to run. I don't think she's going to do it. You stick yourself out personally a lot, and you get a lot of crap if you run. And I think Angela had enough of that. But if I do run, I will definitely talk to her first. I think she was a great candidate. She's a great person, and I know her. She's somebody that we've worked well together. Yeah, I'm considering a run. I haven't really got into it. It takes a lot. You got to pull together a team. You got to raise money so you can run a serious campaign. So you need fundraisers. You need people to deal with the media. You need a campaign manager. You need a treasurer who can deal with the FEC, which is not easy. There's a lot that goes into it. And so, you know, the first thing I would, if I decided to run, would be, can I pull together a team? And I'm at least a month away from, you know, digging into that, because I have other commitments I've got to fulfill. So that's pretty much where it is right now. And we'll see what happens. Vicky Corden. Have you heard about DeSantis telling bloggers to register if they talk about him online? That man is crazy. I mean, you know, the Republicans talk freedom, and then he's as a repressive, he wants to be a police state dictator. I mean, he's dictating the curriculum to the schools. You can't talk about racism and Black history. You know, he does a lot of preemption of, you know, local government initiatives like COVID health, public health measures. And now he wants to tell bloggers what they can say. Register with who? I mean, this guy is out of his mind. And the scary thing about him is he's not as crazy as Trump. And he's, at least right now, Trump's strongest rival for the Republican nomination. So I hadn't heard, but that sounds like a ridiculous idea that he can't regulate bloggers. I mean, even with the courts packed by right-wingers, that's just too far of an infringement on the First Amendment. So, you know, DeSantis can, that's probably more messaging to his base than a realistic proposal. Via email, we already answered that one. Via email, have you followed CPAC at all? Not really. I did hear a brief report that it's not the CPAC of old, which, you know, had more intellectual, policy-oriented conservatives. And now it's a bunch of people, you know, screaming these tropes that the right does with the culture wars. So that's all I've heard. And that doesn't mean it's not significant, because that's where a lot of the base of the Republican Party is. And it's a far right that we've, you know, got to be concerned about, because it's not just their attacks and scapegoating of, you know, sexual and racial minorities and immigrants, but also their attack on, you know, honest elections. These people are really authoritarians. They want strongman rule, and they want to repress, you know, women and gays and racial minorities. And they do control some states, and we're seeing that in the states they control. So I haven't followed them in detail, but I think they're, we shouldn't dismiss them as marginal. They're not. They've got not a majority of people in this country, far from it, but they got a big enough minority that they can, you know, cause a lot of trouble, particularly in the states they control. Frankie Lee, DeSantis is the new Trump, maybe not as crazy, but just as evil. Amen, Frankie Lee, I think you got it. Via email, what do you think will happen with SCOTUS and student loan debt? I'm afraid they're going to say Biden doesn't have the authority, Congress has got to do it, and then Congress won't do it, at least now with the House, with a small minority of Republicans in control. That's what I think will happen. And I think Biden actually does have the authority. The Supreme Court's going to want explicit legislation. But a lot of the programs instituted to create these loans were not explicitly authorized in the form they were used by Congress. It was under a more general authority. And, you know, over 90% of our loans are federal loans. So the federal government can, you know, if they wanted to, they could wipe all that loan out. And I think that's what they should do at this point. Just wipe the slate clean, let the young people who are in debt get on with their lives, and then set up a plan going forward where public colleges and trade schools are tuition free. And those that need to borrow for their other expenses, because it's more than just tuition, or for private colleges, can borrow at reasonable, no interest rates. You know, the payback should be linked to the inflation rate. But interest, why is the federal government charging interest when they're giving these loans supposedly to encourage people to go to college and get more people more educated? It just doesn't make sense. Shouldn't be a income source for the government. It should be a program that they put money out, people get their education, and then whatever loans they take out get paid back. And it should be paid back on a basis that's scaled to the income of people when they get out of college. So for example, you go through medical school, you end up with a lot of debt. And then people who want to become general practitioners don't, because they need to make more money as specialists. So we're short of general practitioners. That's just one perverse outcome of insisting that people pay these debt back. So the debt should be paid back, scaled to income, and then after 20 years, whatever is left should be just written off. I think that would be a progressive way to extend loans to those that need it to finish college and their expenses. The other thing I'll say is that we should also do like they did during the GI Bill after World War II, where not only was tuition covered, but there were stipends for these veterans so their families could be supported while they're going to college and they could focus on their education and not having to work while they were going to school at the same time. So, yeah, we should be investing a lot more in our education and not squeezing students for debt. And a lot of those debts were incurred with these scam, so-called technical education school, private technical education schools, and people got suckered into real bad situations, like Trump University, you know, that kind of scam. That was pretty extreme. Some of the others have curricula, but they really don't, they aren't good places to go to, you know, get into the job area you're trying to get trained for. So anyway, I think SCOTUS, Supreme Court, is going to kick it to Congress and take it away from Biden. And we're going to, the student debt is going to continue, unfortunately. Scout Trooper 164, Howie, what do you think of the insulin CEO cutting prices, but with a catch? Breaking Points covered this. I didn't see Breaking Points coverage. And the catch, I'm not sure what the catch is. I think insulin CEO, I guess that means the CEOs of the drug companies, or one of them, cut the prices. I think that's partly because of public pressure, and they're doing it for PR reasons. Insulin is not that expensive to produce. The prices should be much lower. I think I heard Bernie Sanders is going to propose that the prices be maxed at $20 a month. But maybe you could put in the chat what the catch is, because I hadn't heard. Eli Schiff, okay, that's the company, but what's the catch? Well, if somebody knows, you know, put it in the chat and we'll get back to it. Via email, thoughts on artificial intelligence. Has been in the news a lot lately. Recently with ChatGPT in the spotlight and commentary on the impact it could have on workers. Well, I think like a lot of technologies, how it's introduced is really important. If it reduces labor, then it should be done in a way where the value that workers add to the product, which would include using all the technology, including artificial intelligence, should go to the workers after the expenses, you know, the investments and so forth are covered by, and the other overhead are covered by the firm. And that's what the longshoremen on the West Coast negotiated when they went to containerized shipping with a lot more automation. So those workers got reduced working hours, higher pay, without a loss of jobs. And that's how to introduce technology. The other side of artificial intelligence is it's getting to the point where it can be used to take power and knowledge and as well as income away from us. And that's got to be monitored. And it can be used, you know, like I think it's being used for these, what do they call them? Fake, what do they call them? These videos that are, you know, fake. There's a name for it. But, you know, they put the head of somebody, or they put words in their mouth. And it's getting very sophisticated. And, you know, unless you're trained to understand it or see what's changed, you can be fooled by that. And that becomes a way of, you know, propagandizing the public with false information. So that's another thing that has to be watched. So yeah, that's a big issue that I should probably be doing more reading and studying on, because I know it's in the news and I know there's a lot of concerns. But, you know, my first concern is that if it's introduced as a labor-saving, you know, technology, the workers should benefit from that, not just the owners of the companies. Scout Trooper 164, apparently the catch is that insulin that's going to get a cost cut is going to stop being produced and they will be making a new form. In other words, you can buy the old insulin at the lower cost, but they're going to put in new insulin. And I suppose with the patents, it'll be hard for them. It can't be produced generically, and therefore they can charge you more. If that's what I understand it, what it is, that's an argument, or a case for why we need patent reform so that these companies can't hold on to patents for a long time to keep the prices of these things that are produced so high. This is scientific advancement, and science stands on the shoulders of, you know, all the people that went before to bring us to this point. It's part of our commonwealth. And for it to be privatized by companies so they can squeeze us for profits is just wrong. So that gets to how we price pharmaceutical products. And, you know, just thinking of COVID, you know, Pfizer and Moderna made out like bandits when the federal government put in something like $60 billion to help them develop those vaccines. Yet the government's getting no return on the money that was made. It's just going to Pfizer and Moderna. And that's not right. You know, we the taxpayers made that investment. And like any other investor, we should get our return at least. But again, products like these should be, you know, basically in the public domain. That was one of the things, you know, I wrote a news release on behalf of the Green Party nationally calling for the Biden administration to get behind the reform on the patent laws for COVID drugs that was before the World Trade Organization. And Biden, now this is typical of the damn Democrats, Biden said, yeah, he's for that. He said it twice. And but then we found out from reporting that when they went to the World Trade Organization and discussed this proposal, which came from South Africa and India, the U.S. was actually arguing against it behind closed doors or in the, you know, negotiating sessions, defending our pharmaceutical interests, profits, as well as the other company or countries allied with the U.S. on this were Germany and the Netherlands and the U.K. And that's all about, you know, capitalism in the healthcare sector, putting profits before the health of people, which is why, you know, the whole healthcare sector should be a public utility operated at cost for public benefit, not for the private profit of investors. And I say that's true for not just the insurance, which is what Medicare for All is about, but we need a national health service that includes the hospitals and have the doctors and nurses and other staff be public employees. We should have local elected health boards or, you know, regional, metropolitan, regional health boards that oversee these systems so they're accountable. And because besides the profit making, there are a lot of, you know, insider deals being made and kickbacks and things like that between hospital administrations, for example, and private practices that all these doctors got to get into so they have access to the hospital, and all the other sectors of healthcare, from, you know, ambulance companies to elder care to hospice care to funerals. I mean, it's like one fifth of our economy, and there are all these for-profit predators feeding off of it and making it more expensive than it needs to be, which makes it inaccessible to too many people. It's just the most irrational way to run a healthcare system. So, you know, insulin should be in the public domain, produced at cost and sold at cost to the public healthcare system so everybody has access to it. And, you know, then people would, they wouldn't be paying for the insulin themselves, the healthcare system would, and they would have access to it because they're in the system. Everybody in, nobody out. Violet at Content Boutique. I don't understand why we don't get dividends for taxpayer money we give to all those companies we supplement or subsidize. I want cash dividends. I wouldn't say we need cash dividends. I would say we need public dividends so that the revenues of these companies that are attributable to our subsidies and tax breaks and so forth go back into the public treasury. So we pay less taxes. That would be your cash dividend, I guess. Scout Trooper 164, what do you think of the Biden border crisis? I've been hearing that this could benefit the cartels, but I've just started watching the video. Yeah, the drug cartels, they also are in the business of getting migrants to the border, smuggling migrants across the border. And because, you know, entering the U.S. is criminalized, or at least questioned, and the access to due process for your immigration or asylum is broken. They can't handle the cases. They're just shipping people back to the countries they came from, or at least back across the Mexican border. That is inhumane. It's totally immoral. And it does give the cartels another underground business through which they can make money. And, you know, the cartels in Mexico are a huge problem. You know, these criminal organizations in power, in arms, rival the Mexican state. We've had 100,000 people killed. I forget the time frame. Maybe it was in 1 year in Mexico because, you know, anybody that gets in their way, a journalist that investigates them, a rival cartel, and, you know, kill you. And, you know, this is like a war. And I think it comes, we had, you know, this, you know, drug interdiction plan. Rather than what we should do with drug policy is decriminalize drugs, legalize marijuana, regulate it, and decriminalize possession of the hard drugs. That will reduce the underground economy. And alongside that, there should be access to drug treatment for people who are addicted. And then on immigration, you know, I say the border should be open. You know, a lot of people come here and then they make money and they send it back to their families where they came from as remissions. So people should be able to come here and freely, you know, to visit, to shop. You know, that's a big deal across the, you know, border and, you know, places like Tijuana and the American side, or El Paso and the Mexican side. I think it's Juarez. You know, and if people can move freely back and forth, a lot of people are going to come here and make some money and move back. So it would be a two-way street. And we've got to get a handle on this because with climate change and these wars, we have more refugees now than at any time since World War II. And the numbers, it's hundreds of millions are expected over the next couple of decades, at least because of climate change, because areas are becoming uninhabitable and people are migrating just to survive. And if we don't find a way to handle that humanely, and those people can contribute to economies and cover their own, you know, expenses if we set up a way for that to happen. So the whole immigration question's got to be reconsidered. And Biden's got to stop backing down from the Republican, you know, Republicans hectoring him about the border crisis and, you know, all these immigrants coming in. The immigrants are not the problem. The problem is the immigration policy. So there's a lot to do there. And, you know, I guess the bottom line is Biden promised a humane immigration policy and he's done anything but. Snoring potato. Howie Hawkins, would you consider rent increase caps in areas of the country that have been designated low income? Yeah, I think particularly now coming out of COVID and with the production of affordable housing being so low, we should have federal rent control. We did that during World War II. And, you know, it can also be instituted and we should support it at the state level and in many states also at the local level. It depends on state legislation. But, you know, rent control is a good short-term means to keep people in their homes, reduce homelessness, and, you know, keep the economy going so people are working from home rather than out of their car and, you know, getting in situations where they lose their jobs and just creating more problems. The longer term solution is that we've got to massively expand public housing. We got this Faircloth Amendment, which comes out of the Clinton administration with when Andrew Cuomo in New York was the housing secretary. And it says that no new public housing can be built except to replace housing, public housing that we're tearing down. And we're actually tearing it down more than we're building it in the last couple of decades. And so less than 1% of our housing is public housing. In Europe, it's, you know, double digits. It's as high as 60% in the city of Vienna between the cooperative housing and the public housing, or what they call social housing, publicly owned housing. Another thing they do over there is this housing is open to everybody, not just the poor. So it mixes people up by income and, you know, creates more cohesion in society. Whereas what we're doing is we're segregating the poor and racial minorities in public housing. You get concentrated poverty, you get concentrated other problems. And they're segregated and they sort of have a badge on them when they go apply for a job or go to rent a car or, you know, try to apply for a private rental unit. And since they're from public housing, there's a lot of discrimination against those people, even if it's not legal. So we need a whole new approach. And that is, you know, part of the Eco-Socialist Green New Deal we ran on. We want to massively expand public housing, build that housing so it's green, energy efficient, using renewables, using green building materials, make a scattered site so it's not just concentrated in poor areas, but everywhere, and make it mixed income. So there should be, you know, a certain number set aside for low-income people. So they're the ones that need this housing the most. But it should be mixed income so that the poor aren't segregated. And this is something that I think the Greens should champion, and all but a very few people on the left of the Democratic Party, basically DSA members, are pushing for more public or social housing. But that's really the long-term solution. Rent control is the short-term relief. Comments on Marianne Williamson announcing her campaign to challenge Biden in 2024. Good luck. She's a Democrat, so I'm not so worried. You know, it's not like something I could get enthused about. She does pronounce a number of progressive policies. I think her overall message is kind of new agey and not going to appeal to all but the sort of new age middle class folks. So, you know, we'll see what happens. She may do better because it doesn't look like too many people are going to challenge Biden if he does decide to run again, which it looks like he's going to do. But, the Democratic machine is, I mean, if they could stop Bernie Sanders, they're going to, you know, splat her if she gets any traction very easily. Scout Trooper 164, why do people keep believing in what Democrats promise? They've been lying for decades, yet people keep being scared into following them. Well, I think you answered your own question. They're scared of the Republicans, so they settle for the Democrats. You look at the public opinion polling, you know, in the 60%, and it's higher than it's ever been, people would like another party, another major party. You know, as both Democrats and Republicans. So I think it's not so much they believe in what the Democrats promise, is that they believe in what the Republicans promise and they want to stop that. So I think that's really what the base, the biggest base of the Democratic Party is about. It's not because they love the Democrats, it's because they're afraid of the Republicans. Snoring Potato, Howie Hawkins, are you in support of Peter Zeihan's geopolitical strategists push for more corporations to invest in labor in Mexico to bridge current labor shortages? I'm not familiar with this geopolitical strategist Peter Zeihan, but another way to deal with labor shortages is let the Mexican or other country immigrants come and work here where we're short of labor. Mexico needs development. I don't know if transnational corporations is the best way to get to them. I mean, I would prefer an eco-social solution where particularly manufacturing sector and infrastructure sectors like energy, transportation, maybe telecommunications, or publicly owned utilities operating at cost for public benefit. But that's not what we've got in Mexico, even under AMLO, the current guy who's considered more progressive. He's more a populist. There was privatization in recent administrations, and he hasn't reversed that, at least not to any great extent. So we can increase production here for people that want to move here and encourage increased production in Mexico. But if it's under a capitalist regime, it's just going to, you know, use Mexico as a cheap labor reserve in order to extract more profits for producing the same things. It could be produced here too, where the workers would get better wages and benefits. So I guess I'm not in support of just urging the corporations to invest in Mexico. I think we need to invest here and also encourage an eco-socialist path in both countries. Okay, that hour went fast, and even though I've been up since 5 a.m., I seem to have kept my wits about me somewhat. So I appreciate everybody being here. I'm working on some guests in upcoming videos, a reporter who went to Ukraine to the front line, who's a lefty I've known for decades, and then a guy named Rafael Bernabe, who is a senator in Puerto Rico, elected with the Citizens Victory Movement, a third party. I'd like him to talk about both Ukraine solidarity and what's going on in Puerto Rico and how, you know, his third party elected some people. I think that will be of interest to us as Greens. So have a good week, everybody. We'll be back here next week, maybe with a guest, but maybe that'll happen in coming weeks pretty soon. Got some other people in mind, but I'll not speculate on that now. So have a good week, and thanks for being here.